Our GLT investigative series, Landlord v. Tenant, revealed the increasing tensions between landlords and tenants among the working poor who are often forced to live in substandard housing. GLT's Judy Valente today talks with three of the people seeking solutions to the affordable housing crisis in McLean County. They are Vasu Pinamaraju of the McLean County Regional Planning Commission, Jeremy Hayes of the Bloomington Housing Authority, and Laura Furlong of the Mark First Social Service Agency, who led a study on housing needs for the League of Women Voters of McLean County. Furlong tells Valente that the League study found three major issues that need to be addressed when it comes to creating additional affordable housing.
One was that there was a need for affordable, supportive, permanent housing for people in our community, that we didn't have enough of that. We also realized that there wasn't just one entity looking at housing. There were a lot of silos looking at housing for disability, housing for families, but not necessarily a global picture of what was happening in our community in terms of that. And so the thought was we really need a body that's going to look globally in our community about housing needs and moving forward on what solutions we might have for housing needs as well. We also realized that there, again, along with that, that we really had a need for global data. There was not a global one-stop shop, if you will, for what was happening in the housing world. And so it was very hard to get a picture of what was happening in the community as a whole.
One thing that was intriguing about your study was that you found that people make a lot of money in McLean County. However, the cost of rental housing had shot up, as well as the percent of income that people pay for their rental units. What did you make of that?
Well, the recommendation is that people not spend more than 30% of their income on housing. And we found that we had a large population, a portion of our population that spent between 30 and 50% of their income on housing. And we even had a few percentage points of folks that spent more than 50%.
What kind of hardship, then, does that place on the family? Are they having to balance food, medicine, rent?
Childcare would be another issue, absolutely. So something is going to have to give when you're, and that's why they say that 30%, that's a very common number that you'll hear nationally. HUD uses that number as well. But once you get over that, something has to be compromised. Quality childcare, good nutrition and health for your families, those are things that end up getting compromised.
Vasu Pinamaraju, you work with the Regional Planning Commission. You saw this study. What have you been doing about some of the issues that the League of Women Voters raised?
The League study was very intriguing. That was right around the same time as we were working on Bloomington Comprehensive Plan. League study made it very clear that we have to absolutely look at this regionally. So we were the lead agency, but definitely we partnered with Bloomington Housing Authority, City of Bloomington, Town of Normal, and many community partners like Mark First to undertake the study. At this point, we are towards the end of completing a regional housing study to understand the comprehensive needs. And like Laura pointed out, one of the biggest challenges that we have in this area is lack of data. While with this study, we were able to gather some really good data that helps us quantify some of the issues that we've heard.
You've shared some of the preliminary results of your study. You have a statistic on the median amount of rent that people pay.
Correct.
But that doesn't tell the full story.
Absolutely. So the good news about this study is it came out and said McLean County is generally affordable. If you just stop at that statement and think about it, we are generally a very affordable community for the most part. But the problem really lies with percentage of our population that cannot afford those rents. But most importantly, the affordable rentals, when we talk about apartments at about a median rent of $650 to $750, that is generally considered affordable. But what we don't have information on is the quality of affordable housing. And those are the soft aspects that we recognize that data cannot tell the full story.
In our series, the people that we focused on were people who are working. They have jobs. They're the working poor. And yet they're struggling all the time to pay high rent in housing that is sometimes so substandard that it's crumbling. But what needs to be done to help?
Today, as I sit here and talk to you, I don't think I can tell you that this study has identified all the solutions. But what it has identified as a key recommendation is we need to have a multi-jurisdictional public-private group group looking at these issues and addressing these much more holistically than we had in the past. And as soon as the study is presented to our commission, which it is scheduled to be done on November 1st, that's one of the key recommendations that we are going to act on as soon as possible to form a group to start addressing some of these. And one of those could be education and awareness. Many of the tenants, which you have pointed out in your story, probably aren't aware of their rights. The second one is code enforcement aspects, which you also have addressed in your piece. We need to look at those. There are many other things that we should take a look at existing regulations and incentives to see if they're aligned with where we want to go as a community.
Jeremy Hayes, you're with the Bloomington Housing Authority. Approximately how many low-income subsidized housing units are there in our area?
Well, we have two main subsidized housing programs that the Housing Authority administers. The first of those is public housing, and that's a pretty simple direct model. The Housing Authority owns and manages housing units that are available to people who qualify on income basis. We have 620 leasable units in our housing stock in the public housing program. There's another 800 housing choice vouchers that are available, and people commonly refer to that as Section 8. So those two programs provide a tremendous benefit because they both offer safe, affordable, decent housing to people at a rent that is based on their income. So 30% of their income is what their rent is set at. Whether their income is $400 a month or $1,400 a month, that income, their income determines their rent. That's a great resource to families, but there are thousands more families who would qualify for those programs than we have available units or vouchers.
Do you have a waiting list, and how large is it?
So on our public housing side, the waiting list is not tremendous. Unlike in some of the big urban metropolitan areas where there are years, multiple years wait for a unit of public housing, here that unit, that wait might be just a few months. It does depend on unit size. Where the tremendous waits come into play is on the Section 8 voucher side.
Why would that be?
Well, vouchers offer the flexibility. You can get your voucher as your family's needs change or your employment, your place of location changes. You can get different landlords. You can find different places to live. And it's an extremely beneficial resource to families who are struggling, whose income fluctuates. But the wait is very long because we don't have nearly enough vouchers that are provided through the federal government, through Department of Housing and Urban Development, to satisfy the need. It's quite simple.
Isn't another problem that the voucher program depends on private landlords, private property owners being willing to participate in the voucher program? So how has that been going? Has the number of landlords willing to participate gone up or gone down, stayed the same?
It fluctuates. It fluctuates, and I think it depends in part on the rental market. So the tighter the rental market is, the less incentive there is for landlords to participate, and vice versa. When things are not as tight in the rental market, they may be more inclined to get that assurance of payment through the Section 8 program. In general, we have some great landlords that have been partners and participated in the program and do a great service.
Visu and Laura, feel free to jump in. This question is really for both of you. The city floats bonds. They work with developers when they want a hotel, a downtown hotel built. What is the problem with getting private developers to get more affordable housing and quality housing? Laura, is it a matter of will, lack of will?
I do think the data is going to be helpful, because when we go apply for those resources to bring to our community, we have to have the data. We have to say we have this many families or this composition of family that needs support. And so I think that that will help us. I also think it's knowledge about our community. There's certainly tax credits that would be available for developers that don't necessarily have to come through the city. There are state or federal resources that we can bring here. But again, it's that partnership. I think it also goes back to the supportive housing piece. Many people, I'm sure that Jeremy's Bloomington Housing Authority supports and that the study showed us, was that people can be successful in community-based housing with some level of support. That can be anything from budgeting to personal care to successful managing a home if you've never managed a home before. And so we need to, as a community, pull those supports together. So when a developer says, hey, I want to come here, I want to build some accessible units, we have to be able to say, here's the supports to keep those people successful. Could be, again, mental health. And it also could be people who have not managed their own home, own apartment before. And so they need to know how, and this seems very simple, but how do I safely use a stove, an oven, a microwave, a washer, dryer? I mean, those type of basic domestic skills some people need to be successful.
Part of the problem is if you have a large family, one of the families that we interviewed in our series on landlord-tenant, the woman had six children. She's now living in a two-bedroom apartment. That's hard. What about homes for folks like this? There's apparently apartments available, but what about single-family homes?
Well, I can speak to the great benefit of the voucher program is that you have that flexibility, and there are single-family homes that are rented, detached single-family homes that are rented through the Section 8 voucher program. But
how many compared to apartments?
Well, I'm sure the bulk of our units would fall into multi-unit structures. There are some innovative things that are happening around the country when it comes to affordable housing, and I think that's where a group that is focused in on housing at an interjurisdictional level here locally will help to introduce some of these newer ideas.
Mm-hmm. Laura, I see you writing some notes when Jeremy was answering that. What's your take on it?
Well, and I think there's just a couple of things. Our study also talked about people being eligible for housing authority units in the voucher system. So there are some obstacles, like a certain criminal history, certain backgrounds, certain behaviors, and certainly composition of families if there's not units available. And so, again, I think our study and a global look at that in our community will be very important. I think one example you asked about, Judith, was, you know, are there homes available? So there was a recent, I don't know recent anymore, but tax credit deal that was done for a developer to go and take homes that had been foreclosed on and redo those homes and get those ready for our community as a whole. And those were actually put on the statewide referral network as well for people with disabilities or other folks who had specific needs in the community. What I understand is many of those, again, probably lack of knowledge of those people knowing how to access those. Many of those did not necessarily go to people with vouchers or people with needs. And once they weren't, they were on the market for, I believe, 90 days, then they can go to the common public. So I'm not sure those resources were used the way that the tax credit was intended to do.
So there are some creative ways to go about. What else have you heard that other cities are doing that Bloomington Normal could follow as a model, perhaps?
I will add to what Jeremy said earlier about some of the incentives available for developers who I think there is education aspect to it, but then these are not easily navigable. So there needs to be some assistance that developers can use to really take advantage of these.
Assistance from where? From the government, or the local government? Or
I think this interjurisdictional group that's going to be put together, I'm hoping that we start talking about issues like this, because there are several aspects to this that help close the gap between what the market can support on its own and the gap that exists to make these units affordable.
You know, I've only lived in the community 12 years. Some people have lived here their whole lives. But since I've been here, there's so much farmland that's gone to development.
Oh, yes.
And they've gone to these wonderful, big, beautiful houses. Why has not some of that gone to moderately priced housing?
That's actually, as part of our study, one thing that we have found out is McLean County is generally overbuilt, particularly with single-family houses.
Overbuilt, you're saying?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. With single-family
houses.
Except they're not affordable to the working poor who may need them.
Correct. So there is a mismatch between, for particular underserved population, there is a lack of housing inventory that serves that population. And if you look at the population growth for the past two decades in this county, we have been a very growing community. So the housing tends to be built for a certain market. So we have definitely found that our population growth rate has slowed down, and we do have an overbuilt situation now. yet there is a mismatch between the size of the household today to the square footage of the houses being added to the market. That adds to the overall affordability issue.
Yeah, we don't need to necessarily be building such huge McMansions, is what you're saying.
Yes, and you know there are a variety of models that actually go to affordability, supportive housing. So there are models out there. We just have to be creative and more explicit and provide the gap that exists. And honestly, this is the first time a study at a regional level is showing that gap.
Well, Laura, in your league study that you worked on, it showed that the median income is relatively high in McLean County.
Yes. I mean, I think as we compare ourselves with Champaign, Peoria, we have a very high income.
I can tell you that most recently, the median family income for Bloomington Normal is $79,600. So just short of $80,000 is the median family income.
That's a pretty high rate, but it's elevated by all the folks who work at ISU, the professors' salaries, and the folks at State Farm, the white-collar people.
Right. And that actually gets to, I think, some misunderstandings about who qualifies for the different subsidized housing programs, one of which is low-income housing tax credit, or LIHTC, or LIHTC, you'll sometimes hear it referred to, and that is the number one way that new affordable housing is getting built, is through that program.
LIHTC. And it stands for?
Low-income housing tax credit. You'll sometimes just hear it referred to as tax credit housing. There have been a couple of tax credit housing proposals recently, and they cover incomes that are, I think, much higher than what a lot of people recognize. In fact, it's a great program, but it serves the higher end of the affordable market. What has to happen in a lot of affordable housing programs is there's a layering of subsidy so that you might have portions of the development that are available to people with incomes that are 50% of median income or 60% of median income, and then maybe you still reserve a small percentage for those that are maybe 30% of median income. And most of the population that are currently served in public housing and the voucher programs, they're down at that 30-40% of median income.
So, what would you say their median income is on average?
We're talking about, I can tell you in public housing, on the public housing side, we have a median family income of around $11,000.
So there's a huge gap between that
gap.
And what we're saying is the median income for the county as a whole. And that directly relates then to the cost, the rental prices that landlords are charging. Now, on the league study, you found that McLean County was $200 more than Peoria and more than Champaign, more than Macon County even, more than Sangamon County.
And I think if we look at Champaign as well, you look at those university communities, and we've seen that here locally. We've seen a lot of lovely developments for student housing that are not the people that Jeremy's talking about who have the $11,000, you know, family income a year. So,
and the folks that we met in doing our landlord-tenant series, they were paying fairly high rents for very low quality places. How do you deal with that, Laura?
I will do that. So I think we need to think about our expectations for landlords. Should all landlords have a unit or two that is at to meet that lower income level, folks? I think we have to be very cautious at a community to build huge communities or city blocks or whatever it looks like where we've got all people with very low income. I'm not sure from a healthy standpoint that that's really good for people who would need supportive housing and to be successful. So I think we need to think about spreading people across our community so we can learn from each other. And I think that that's a very key piece. So I really don't want to see us say, hey, we need seven high rises where everyone's going to be at that lowest income level of $11,000. Because I think that will cause us to have different issues not really allow us to have those supports in place for people to be successful in housing.
Another theme that kept coming up with folks who are low income and renting is landlords have the upper hand so often. How do you feel about the way the law is written? Are there adequate protections for low income renters? Let me pose that to Jeremy.
Well, there has to be awareness, obviously. I mean, tenants need to be aware of their rights.
Well, how do we make them aware of their rights?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, Prairie State Legal is our sort of go-to legal aid organization in town, and they do make a lot of effort to do outreach. It can't be at a time when you're in a crisis as a tenant when you start to figure out problem solving. Unfortunately, people do try to occasionally do things where they withhold rent, and they are so, in such a crisis that it's hard to figure out how to respond. I mean, we have them as a resource in town. Both of the municipalities obviously are involved in, with code enforcement. It's hard to slowly build the knowledge out there about how tenants can protect themselves and how they can have a cooperative relationship with their landlord. I mean, that's part of what I do every day is working with tenants, and we say, communication is the key, and it has to, of course, also be met on the landlord side with some understanding and some efforts at communication to cooperatively solve the problems that come up.
One final thing. There are people who are sitting in their comfortable homes who worked hard to pay for those homes who might be saying, why should I care about this? Why should my tax money go to helping a developer build housing for lower income people? How do you convince the taxpayers of this community that this is important? This is an important use of their tax money. Jeremy, I see you wanting to jump in.
Right. This is an issue that actually touches everybody much more than what they realize. It's the people who take care of your children, the people who care for your elderly parents, the people who take care of you at the grocery store, who do a big chunk of the service jobs in the community that really need some sort of assistance in the form of subsidy or on the development side, creating the developments where they can afford. We can't afford to just dismiss a big chunk of our economy, both as employees and as other consumers too. We can't just dismiss that chunk of the economy. It benefits everybody.
Laura?
Yeah, and I agree. If we don't invest in that workforce, we're going to have gaps all over our community and have needs that aren't met. I think we also need to consider that people who don't have housing are going to require a higher level of service. They're going to end up in the ER. They're going to end up homeless. They're going to end up needing very much more supports. And so I think it is an investment up front that saves us money in the long run.
As a community, this is a more sustainable way of growing a community. As we look at who we are, this is one of the fundamentals of how a community should grow.
Thank you, Vasu Pinamaraju, who is with the Regional Planning Commission for McLean County. Laura Furlong is the CEO of Mark First. She also headed a study for the League of Women Voters of McLean County on housing needs. And Jeremy Hayes is the Development Director for the Bloomington Housing Authority. Thanks so much to all three of you. I'm Judy Valente.
The Regional Planning Commission is expected to discuss findings from its two-year study of a variety of needs, including gaps in the county's existing housing stock, at a meeting on November 1st. Find the four-part series, Landlord v. Tenant, at our website, wglt.org.